Welcome to the Work, Wealth, and Travel Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole, and this podcast is your guide to start creating a lifestyle by design. From entrepreneurship, money and finance, taxes and residencies, and everything in between, this show highlights the nuances of a true global citizen lifestyle. Let's dive in.
Stephen, welcome to the Work, Wealth, and Travel Podcast. I'm so excited to dive in today. Finance is a topic that I love, and I know that the audience loves from various different perspectives. Before we dive in, would you mind sharing a little more about yourself, your story, your journey, where you started, and how you got to where you are today?
Thank you for having me on your podcast, Nicole. I'm an investment person. I've managed private portfolios for 45 years or so, including my own. I've also managed to see the world during that period of time with lots of vacations all over. But basically, I come from, and you know, I don't come from a poor background. I come from a upper middle class background. I've never really had any financial problems to speak of. So I've been very, very fortunate in that regard. So I had the opportunity to get started with investments right away. I mean, like most people, when they get their first job, they're putting money away to buy their first car, or they're, you know, saving for college, or, you know, and then throughout life, you're saving, always saving for something, and everything has got a purpose in the future. Most of that, I kind of skipped over a lot of that stage, and I was able to start accumulating when I was still, you know, a teenager in summer jobs. My voyage to where I am today was a lot smoother sailing than most. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that there were lessons learned during that travel that could apply to anybody as soon as they have a chance to put anything away at all. You know, if you have to start small, you have to start small. But the idea is that you start to focus, instead of focusing on trying to find that next Google or Amazon stock situation where you get rich overnight, or playing, which is a lot like the lottery. You know, we don't know the next Amazon. We no one knows which one that's going to be. But if you start putting your money away and earning a good level of income and compounding that income and diversifying and stuff like that, you'll wind up, as I did, when you were in your early 30s, generating more income. I wouldn't call it quite passive income, but investment income. By the time I was 34, I was earning five times what I was making in my New York City job, you know. And at that point, I said, you know, well, I can do this for other people. So the journey was, at that point, it changed from getting ahead in this company, which in my mind, I wasn't advancing fast enough. I was making more money than they were paying me by a long shot. My wife was making more than I was as a paralegal, so I could afford to cut the cord and start a business, which I did. And two of my friends were good enough to give me 25 grand or so to start. And that and my own was all I had to going for me. And my wife was supporting me. And we had two kids, and we had a house and all that stuff. And we were living on her income and my income from my investment portfolio probably for 4 or 5 years before I even paid myself a salary. Now I've, you know, last May, I sold that business for, you've heard the expression, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I did that. And I didn't know that I wouldn't get that money all in one lump sum. But I was fortunate enough to have a portfolio that generated more than enough income to get us through that process and wait for next May when I get the rest of the money. You know, so it didn't matter when I got the final sum. And in fact, the year I cut the cord, so to speak, I started my book. I published that. And my wife and I had all these leftover COVID adventures, mostly on the African continent, like Morocco and Egypt, and safaris in South and Central Africa that but we weren't going to just write them off just because I had left my job. So we did that too. And just like in the book, we paid for it from the income that I was producing for the most part.
I love that. What a great journey. Thank you for sharing that. So I have quite a few questions, but I think where I want to start is really talking about managing, first of all, your portfolio, and then moving on to managing others and client portfolios. And I find that very interesting. And I know when I was reading up about you a little bit as well, it mentioned that, because what I like about that is that most, when I'm thinking, you know, the typical hedge fund manager or mutual fund, they are managing that for other people. But because their skin is not in the game, per se, a lot of the time, it doesn't really matter to them the outcome because they are making a percentage anyways. So what I like from your journey is that it sounds like you started investing and playing with your own money and then moving that over to clients. So you knew what worked and you also had skin in the game. You wanted your clients to really truly win because you were also invested in all of those assets as well.
Exactly. You know, one of the things I used to tell them, I said, I will never buy anything for you that I don't own or have not owned myself. And I do the same thing today. Even in my group, I avoid mentioning individual issues because that's just not what professionals don't give tips and picks and things like that. They give strategies and procedures and here's where you research this for your own specific needs. But yeah, you're right. I always felt that way. I never did anything for anybody else. And I always did have skin in the game. Even now when I'm not managing money for anybody but myself, I'm still telling them, you know, I sell you this universe of securities that I use. I own every one of them. So I'm not recommending them. I'm just saying they meet my requirements. You determine if they meet yours. So yeah, my first portfolio started developing when I was 25, actually. And I had maybe 20 different stocks I didn't go to the Ivy League school. I went to Gettysburg College out in central Pennsylvania instead. And I had a lot of money left over. My parents had a lot of money left over in my college fund. And I had given my father 25% of everything I made when I was a kid, because he made me do that. This is part of the price of me taking care of you. You know, I get this, I put it away for you, and you'll have it when you grow up. I'm not sure I grew up soon enough, but when I got that chunk of stocks, I literally got stock certificates, envelope full of stock certificates. Most young people have never seen a stock certificate. Used to be, you didn't have to keep your portfolios with a brokerage firm or a Fidelity or one of these online, there were no online outfits actually, but you could get the company to give you the actual certificates, the paper documents that were the contract that you owned to share this company. So that's what that got dumped on my 25th birthday plate. And I was given the task of, you know, make sure you don't lose this because it's all you're going to get from me, that type of thing. So that's what I did. I studied it. I studied the market cycle, how it seemed to flow up and down, and how changes in economies and global situations and news media and pandemics, even more recently, change things and alter the direction. But that the basic quality of the companies involved, the ones that I owned, never changed, you know? An oil company was an oil company was an oil company. It really didn't matter what was going around it. Its price went up and down, but its dividends kept getting paid and maybe got increased every six quarters or stuff like that. I was going to say Sears, for example, but that's not a good example because they're not in business anymore. But at that time, they were a big name. General Electric, all those types of companies, you know, the Dow stocks, if you will, were what I owned. I finally realized in looking at the volatility of the prices that over a course of 20 years, you could have sold the security at a profit, bought it again, and sold it again and bought it again, sold it again, probably 100 times during that period of time, maybe more.
So my next question based off of that, that I'm very curious about, is how do you specifically develop a well-performing portfolio, of course, both for yourself and for your clients? What are in these portfolios? How are you assessing what is good to hold short or long term? And what sort of income are they producing for you?
I guess the first stage is to understand securities. Stock market securities, the names we mentioned before, like General Electric and Exxon and so on. These are companies. And when you own stock, you actually own shares and equity interest in those things. And every corporation raises its initial capital by a sale, an IPO of its shares. And people buy them and then they trade them. And the prices go up and down over the years based on all kinds of things. Supply and demand is the primary force. And the reasons for that will vary from time to time. But every corporation also raises money to fund its operations, to grow, by issuing debt securities. And debt securities can be anything from preferred stock, which is kind of a hybrid convertible type security, to corporate bonds, loans, liens, and so on. And they use that money to buy additional properties or build buildings or hire the better employees or buy other companies. They use a lot of debt in their operations.
Are you interested in becoming a global citizen and living a lifestyle by design in a country that aligns with you? If this is a lifestyle that you're seeking to create, we can help. Whether it be multiple residencies, citizenships, bank accounts, trusts, or company formations, we operate in 30 plus of the most tax-friendly jurisdictions around the globe to get you structured properly. Head to the link in the show notes to learn more and to get your global citizen journey underway today.
And in the long run, the debt securities are safer than the equity securities of the same company, because in the event of bankruptcy, and we've all heard of Enron, and you've heard of Merrill Lynch going under, even though Bank of America did buy them back up, and others during the Great Recession, other banks and other types of companies that have gone bankrupt, shareholders get zero. It's very rare that a shareholder gets a penny back on his investment, whereas bondholders and lien holders usually do get some money on the dollar. You know, they may get 20 cents on the dollar, but at least they get something. So stocks are riskier than bonds. Bonds are more volatile based on what's going on with interest rates than stocks. Stocks are more a reflection of what's going on in the overall economy. So once you know that and you start to build a portfolio, you want to divide your assets so that you're not all in the riskier stock market type security, but you're also in the bonds. And depending on your age and your wealth and your prospects for the future will determine how much you want to have in each category. Younger people will have as much as 70% in the equity markets. And people my age, I have 35, about 35% in the stock market, and the rest is in income purpose securities. So that's kind of step one, is to determine where you should be, which of these things you should be. And then you have several things to look at to determine what to buy. And the first of those things is the quality of the company. You don't just go out and buy something because you heard about it in a chat room or on the radio or anything like that. You really have to do some research and find out what this company is all about. One of the questions I always use was, is it profitable? I never buy companies that aren't profitable. I always insist that they pay me a dividend. Even the dividends, though normally dividends are not all that great, they're not nearly as much as they pay their senior executives and people like that. But still, it's a good indicator to have also If a company ever cuts their dividend, you know they're in trouble of some kind, because that's just the impression it gets. You'll see stocks go down tons when they announce a dividend cut. They don't ever want to do that. And that's one of the reasons probably why they keep their dividends relatively low. Bonds, on the other hand, are more inclined to move up and down based on interest rate expectations. But all of those also have ratings that you can research to determine which are the quality ones. So quality is the first way you minimize your risk. And the younger you are and the smaller your portfolio, the more you should be concerned about minimizing risk, and the less you should be concerned about playing the lottery and trying to discover the next superstar company and getting lucky. That just doesn't happen that often. I guess if you owned enough IPOs, you'd probably maybe hit a winner every now and then. But when would you know to sell that winner? And most people hold them until they no longer are. So that's the selection. And then you have to diversify your holdings. So I've given you three basic rules already of what to do in developing a portfolio. You want to come up with quality judgments, you know, ways to determine the quality. You want to make sure it's paying you income. The next is that you want to diversify, and you want to try to have, and it's very difficult with a small portfolio, but I'm going to give you a solution for that. But you want to have less than 5% in your portfolio, so that if one of the things you owned, whether it's a stock that stops defaults and stops paying its interest, or a company that goes out of business, you don't want to have that have a major impact on your portfolio. You want to blink an eye. That's all you want. So how does somebody get started in all this? There are three types of securities that lump together a diversified portfolio that you can buy. You can buy a diversified portfolio, an income-producing portfolio, right from the start. You then just have to determine the quality of those portfolios, and there are similar tests to determine that, like you don't want anything that's brand new. You want it to have a five-year track record. You want it to have at least 50 different securities inside itself, things of that nature. In my book, The Retirement Money Secrets, I spend probably a third of the book just going over these six principles of how to select and get the quality and the income and the diversity in your portfolio. The other three things that I talk about are the nature of the markets themselves. You have to recognize that the markets always go up and down. They always have, they always will. I've lived through 3.1 market meltdowns since I started investing back in back when I was 25 years old, which would have been 1970. You know, and each time the market always bounced back, but each time hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people panicked and sold everything. And they usually do that right at the bottom. I never did that. And because I never thought the world was coming to an end, but I've actually literally had that a conversation with a client where he said, "Steve, it's different this time. It's all over. The country's done. You got to get out. You got to just hope for the best, but you don't want to be in stocks anymore." And he sold all his money at the bottom of the market in the crash of 87. But, you know, the thing is that if you have the right types of securities, you don't have to worry so much about market volatility. And by selecting those securities, knowing the market's volatile, using those four principles, the quality, make sure your income, diversifying properly. The fourth one is make sure you take your profits. Most people never sell for a profit. The tax code is a big culprit there, because the tax code benefits people who take losses much more than it does people who take profits. A lot of people misguidedly take losses all the time just to keep from paying taxes. That's like giving away $100 so that you don't have to pay $30 in taxes. You know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The final thing that you have to do in developing your portfolio is to focus on what the portfolio is going to do for you when you finally need it, when you want to say, I don't want to work anymore, when you want to say, I want to go travel, I want to see the world. The only thing you can do that with is income. Otherwise, you have to sell securities and deplete your capital. So I always tell people to focus on the income, and the market value will pretty much take care of itself. That's the way to set up your portfolio at whatever age you happen to be. Let's say you're in your 60s or 65 even, and you're getting that big lump sum out of your IRA, and you want to say, okay, I got this seven figures in my IRA, and now I want to use that to travel the world. Well, you don't want to just go spend $30,000 and get on that cruise ship. What you want to do is make sure your portfolio is generating hundreds of thousands of dollars so that you can use that to go on your cruises or to take your excursions. And I help people design portfolios.
So I want to talk about the 4% rule. So the 4% annual withdrawal rule and how that can benefit somebody for retirement, but also potentially once you have a big enough portfolio before retirement. So do you mind explaining what the 4% is rule and what the 4% rule is and how somebody could benefit from that?
Okay. The 4% rule is what most financial advisors tell you. You should be able to deduct from your portfolio in retirement. And they're talking about 4% of the market value of the thing. So let's say in 2022, when the market hit its bottom, the 4% number you'd be getting wouldn't be nearly as much as it was at the end of 2021 when the market was at its peak. So it would be a variable amount, and most people will be taking this amount monthly. But my problem, and that the 4% rule seems to be a good number. I mean, most of my clients were taking just about that from their portfolios. The difference was that I was actually producing 8 or 9% for them, and I was just setting aside that income to pay it to them every month. So they never had to sell anything. The basic way that the 4% rule is handled in advisory accounts or personal accounts today is by selling assets. And most professionals and most amateurs are in an environment where they fall in love with some securities because they've gone up in value, and they hate the other securities because they haven't. And they wind up selling the securities that they hate. And in doing so, they're taking losses. And when you take a loss, that decreases your productive capital. I work on a system that focuses more on the capital invested, like Monopoly would, or a real estate rental operation would, than I do the market value of the securities. So when I take 4%, I'm saying my client's account is going to generate 4% in realized income. So the 4% rule is a good rule. The way it's implemented today is bad. I mean, we've had a situation where the stock market now is just barely ahead of where it was 2 years ago. So say you were retired and you were taking 4% of your portfolio out each of those 2 years. Not only would have been just now getting back to where it was in market value, but it would still be down 8% because of what you took out. So that's one reason that I like the 4% rule, but I don't like the way it's implemented. The other problem with the implementation today is most investors are almost pressured by their advisors to automatically reinvest their dividend and their distributions. And what this does, it does a couple bad things. It puts more money than you should have in individuals in one security, so because some pay more dividends than others, so you're going to get an over proportion in one security over the others, and many of yours don't pay any distributions at all, so those are kind of abandoned in this process, so you wind up with bad diversification. Also, when you have to take your money out, they have to sell something. They can't just take it from income because that you've already reinvested it automatically. So now they must, every month, they must take make sales, even at losses, to give you your income. So I have a lot of problems with the 4% implementation program, but very little with the 4%, the idea of 4%. My portfolios are comprised of securities whose main purpose in life is to generate income for the clients. And I think we spoke about funds a while ago. There are three types of funds. There are closed-end funds, which were the first funds ever invented, probably in Europe, but started in the United States in the mid-1800s. Then mutual funds came to the fore about 30 years later, but they never became popular really until after the Depression. And then the third one, the ETFs, which are extremely popular now, only were developed in the 90s, you know? So the two later ones, the mutual funds and the ETFs, are designed and the mutual funds are managed to grow their assets, and the ETFs are passively managed, and hopefully the people who construct them have put the right things in there to make them grow in value. But neither of them are focused on generating income for shareholders. The older one, the closed-end funds, though, are trusts. They're called pass-through trusts, and they're required by law to pay out 95% of their earnings. So, A, they don't have enough freedom with their income to reinvest it to grow their market value because they have to give it all to shareholders. And B, they don't issue enough shares to become as popular. They don't have enough shares to become popular enough to go into things like 401ks, which have requirements about the internal expenses within funds. So that's why mostly you'll find Vanguard funds and those that are, 0.5% annual fees, you'll find those kind of funds ETFs in your 401ks and not closed-end funds. Closed-end funds pay an average right now about 10% after expenses. So you never pay these expenses, but the internal expenses, and that's the way the government does it, FINRA and whoever else monitors what goes into 401ks, they do it simply by how much does the provider make. If they make more than 2%, they can't be in an IRA or a 401k. That's their rules. So did I answer? Let's see. Did I answer the question? The 4% rule is a good rule. It's based on market value. So in the down market, you're taking a lot of losses and you're selling, you're getting rid of your portfolio capital. You need to be in a portfolio that generates more than 4%, and then it's a very viable rule. It's a very viable rule. I spend more than 4% of my income, but it doesn't keep me from reinvesting, the other 6%. So
I know there are so many other directions that we could go in, but to keep it fairly digestible, I think we'll end here. But I do want to ask you if there's something that we haven't touched on that is important to touch on for anybody listening to this conversation.
Well, I think I touched on it before. And I guess to me, the most important thing is to get yourself focused on income. A lot of people say, and on profit taking, they say they don't want to take profits. They don't want to generate more income because they'll have to pay taxes. And this is out of their income, their investment portfolio. Here they are saying, I don't want more money. I've got enough money. So think about this. Would you ever go into your boss's office and say, hey, stop. I don't want you to give me that bonus that year, and I don't want to raise in salary because I don't want to pay more taxes? That's exactly what you're doing when you deny investing for income or for taking your capital gain. Try to think of it in that way. I don't know. Maybe that'll help.
So, Stephen, thank you for sharing everything you've shared today, where can people find you and your book online?
I'm online at theincomecoach.net, and my book is easy to see in the stores if you go to a regular store, but that's what it looks like, Retirement Money Secrets, and it's at all the usual online places like Amazon and so on, and it talks about all the things we've discussed here today and quite a bit more, and it gives you a whole lot more information about those closed-end funds, which are really, you know, they're really a kind of money machine when you really get into looking at them and seeing how many they are and how diverse they are. Anything you can buy in a stock or a bond, you can buy in the form of a closed-end fund.
You've just listened to the Work, Wealth, and Travel podcast. If anything from this episode resonated with you, I would appreciate if you share this podcast on your socials. And of course, be sure to tag me. And don't forget to leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you for joining me on this global citizen journey, and I'll see you in the next episode.